do something that is different. And you look at all the heroes, and that's what they do.
The commitment to listen with the same passion with which we want to be heard.
In terms of who do you want to be, articulate that. Find the words behind that. Who do you want to be?
Greetings and welcome back to the DNA of Purpose podcast, the place where we empower you to build trust, champion adaptability, and cultivate the courage to unleash your unique DNA of purpose. Here we provide the insights, tools, and mindset shifts essential for sparking conversations, leading teams, rallying communities, and influencing the cultural shifts to steer humanity towards the solutions that are reshaping our future today. The world of work is undergoing a transformation like never before. With leaders focusing on the intersection of artificial intelligence, ESG, environmental and social governance, diversity and inclusion, we find ourselves in one of the most progressive eras in history. That said, this shift has left traditional norms and processes struggling to keep up with the pace of change. The question has now moved beyond what does it mean to be human in the reflection of technology, with the focus now shifting on, well, what does it mean to be human when we are evolving at breakneck speed? And maybe more significantly in the context of the workplace, how does this evolution inform how we, as leaders, should be curating an employee's experience of work? How should we be measuring workplace performance in the context of remote working models? What's abundantly clear to me is that business as usual will no longer suffice. The familiar systems, processes, and procedures we've cherished are no longer fit for purpose. And that is why today I wanted to feature a guest who has birthed innovative, out-of-the-box solutions to support human resources. A person who has driven revolutionary ideas that have redefined employee experience, talent management, and workplace performance. Her name is Kelly Ressler, and she is an American author and consultant who has left an indelible mark on the world of work with her pioneering ideas in workplace flexibility and performance management. Today, she is the Director of Global Employee Experience for Accenture, and she is one of the co-founders of the groundbreaking Results-Only Work Environment, otherwise known as ROW, which challenges the traditional norms of evaluating employees based on the number of hours worked and where, instead placing a sharp focus on performance and results. Kelly co-authored the influential book, Why Work Sucks and How to Fix It, outlining the principles of ROW and how it can revolutionize organizations, leading to improved productivity and enhanced employee satisfaction. Her body of work aligns perfectly with the changing landscape of work, echoing the themes of organizational change, business purpose, and innovative work models that we, of course, explore on this podcast. And so, without any delay, please welcome to the DNA of Purpose the one and only Kelly Ressler. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. It is such a joy to have Kelly Ressler beaming in all the way from Minnesota. So excited to have you joining us.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. I'm very excited to be here.
And I am so excited to hold space for your journey, which, having done a little bit of background research, sounds like it has been one wild ride and one that has been infused with a sense of purpose.
Very good way to put that. Yes, I would agree.
So in that case, let's dive into question one. I wanted to kick off with a question that I ask all of my guests on the podcast. Now, as you can imagine, I get to ask an awful lot of questions, and I also have the privilege of directing those questions to some of the most purpose-driven leaders, change makers, and consultants on the planet. And what I'm curious to know is what awesome questions these people ask themselves. So what I'd love to know from you is, what question are you currently pondering that is guiding your work forward?
Yes. And I'm sure you probably get a multitude of answers to this question from the amazing people that you speak with. And to frame up the question that I'm pondering, I am going to spend just a minute really talking about the reality that I'm thinking about quite a bit these days, which is that almost 80% of people strongly believe that their employer is responsible for helping them be better off, ultimately help their lives be better, which makes sense since we spend about a third of our lives working. So what does this look like for an employer to help make people's lives better? And fortunately, in my work at Accenture, where I've been for about 7 years, we have done the research that has proven that there are 6 fundamental human needs that people expect to be met through work. And those fundamental human needs are having purposeful work with agency over how, when, and where that work gets done. Being able to grow skills that help fuel career growth and employability. Being financially, physically, and mentally and emotionally well. And lastly, feeling a sense of belonging. And when these basic human needs are met, organizations can unlock 5 times more human potential. So that's the reality that I've been thinking about. And if we go back to what I mentioned a minute ago, which is that 80% of people believe that their employers should be helping them become better in these elements that I just mentioned, only 13% are fully satisfied that that's actually happening today. So that brings me to the question that I'm pondering, which is, how do we close that gap? What's holding leaders back from really stepping up and addressing, what the data very clearly shows and taking action so that all of that human potential can be unlocked? And I've been pondering this for a while, and I definitely don't have any definitive answers yet for how we close that gap, but I have kind of settled into a few things that I think are behind the why in terms of, this gap existing in the first place, which I'm more than happy to dive into as part of our conversation. Or I can stop talking, Rebecca, for a minute and kind of let you jump in. But that's definitely what's on my mind these days.
Whoa, what a starting point. I love it. I have a question a little bit later on in the podcast that's going to lead into some of the challenges of leadership. But since we're here, what I'd love to know is, within your thinking on this particular subject, is there one core leadership skill that you think might be lacking, or one roadblock that you might look at highlighting in the context of what you've just shared with us?
So I know we just talked right before we joined that I listened in on your conversation with Tenille Miller recently, where you both talked about how a whole new type of leader needs to emerge. And I completely agreed with where you went with that, which was leaders who can admit that they don't have all the answers and step aside and let the greatness of others emerge. I loved that thought. And, you know, at the end of the day, this does mean leaders who can let go of their own ego and operate at a higher level of inclusivity and trust. And it's really people that others want to follow because of that authenticity and almost magnetism. And for me, you know, when I think about authenticity, which I think is the answer to your question for me, that one element of what a leader needs to bring, it means that that person is going to be the same, whether you come into contact with them today, next week, next month, in 3 years, you're always going to get the same person. I think people crave this consistency in how people show up. And I think that's a signal for when you know that someone has shed some or most of that ego, when it doesn't matter what situation they're in, whom they're talking with, they show up as themselves, and we can always count on that.
I love that, particularly in reference to your comments about a leader being someone that people can follow. And, you know, counterintuitively, you kind of think that that is, you know, ego-driven, as in the leader has all of the influence and therefore people can follow them. But actually, counterintuitively, that completely centers on consistency, which you shared, but also the ability to contribute. And if you can get those aspects in alignment and get those things into balance with obviously the job you need to get done, it's, you know, it's really from that space that you can really begin to build trust and build authority from a deep place of service, which is incredible.
Completely agree, Rebecca. And I think it's the intertwining of all of that.
Yeah.
And when it happens naturally, and you can feel it happen naturally, that's kind of where the magic is. It doesn't feel forced. And it's something that can organically grow then, that trust, that relationship between people and among people.
So Kelly, I want to jump back in time a little bit so that I can understand the trajectory of your journey. And what I found quite interesting in looking at your background is that you grew up in South America. And in doing my research, I heard you speak so fondly of your dad, who, in your words, really empowered you to step into leadership. In fact, he believed you would be the next president. Your mum, who really allowed you to own your voice and encouraged you to own your voice in the world. And you shared such a beautiful story about your grandfather, who empowered you with the tools to achieve your goals. And I believe one of the most significant goals was learning how to jump rope. And so it sounds like you had a wonderful childhood. And I'd love to learn more about how those foundations really informed your purpose today.
Oh, well, you certainly have done your homework. You know, all of the kind of moments from the people that are very important to me and how they impacted me. And you're right. I think I was very fortunate to grow up with people around me that were continuously encouraging me, motivating me, inspiring me, supporting me. And I never for one day take that for granted, because I know that that is not always the case for people. And so I think that, you know, growing up, I had all of that. And over the last, I would say, 20, 25 years or so, there have been a couple of other moments for me that I would say have continued to shape who I am. And one of those is becoming a parent. My four children have given me a lens on life that really keeps me pushing for more pushing for better. I think many people have a driving force in their lives that kind of helps keep their soul on fire. And for me, that definitely is my children wanting to, you know, create and leave the world in a better place for them, and seeing the world through their eyes, you know, as they've grown through their phases has been also very fascinating, a great learning experience for me as a mother. And secondly, I would say that for about the past 20 years, almost half my life, I have dealt with depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. And as I've learned over time, the strategies that really work for me, I have become better and better at keeping myself healthy and balanced. And as part of that, I'm very, very diligent about how I spend my time. I'm very on purpose, if you will, when it comes to that non-renewable resource that we all have, which is our precious time. You will rarely find me in a meeting, for example, where I don't know my purpose or my role. On the same token, you'll rarely find me inviting people to meetings where there isn't a purpose or isn't an outcome that we're working toward. Time, again, is very precious. And to stay at the top of my game, I know I need time to take long walks, to get the sleep I need, to make the healthy food that that I need, to spend time with my husband, my friends, my children. And I know that when I let those things slip, you know, I've learned my lessons, and I know kind of how that affects me. And so I have committed to myself, and I try to help others as well commit to making sure that whatever's going on in our lives, that we're taking care of ourselves first and foremost. And so I think that, you know, with all of those experiences through my childhood, being encouraged and motivated, having children that have given me a new lens on life, and now really having that focus on caring for myself in the way that I need to, have all just really compounded to put me in this place where I do feel very lucky. I feel very lucky and very fortunate to have had the adventures that I've had and be living the life that I am.
I love your answer, and I really want to unpack it a little bit more, purely because when I talk about purpose, I often refer to purpose as being this energy in motion. And essentially what you're talking about here is energy management. Now, you've spoken firstly about the mirror that is motherhood, and I can absolutely relate to that one. I have a 5-year-old daughter, and as she grows, the more I become acutely aware of how my influence, my reflection on her, is fundamentally shaping her life, and not only shaping her childhood, shaping the entire trajectory of the story she tells herself about herself. And yes, in so many ways, that is just such an enormous responsibility, which at times can become, I'll be honest, a little bit paralyzing, but it's also this like potent vehicle and portal for personal transformation. And in this sense, I think for any mothers who are out there in the working world and who are also high performers, that you might think that parenting and performance are two completely separate influences in your life. But, you know, in my experience, I think they're intrinsically linked. The other thing you spoke about here is boundaries and self-care, not only in relation to how you have juggled 4 children in your case, but also in relation to how we cultivate a relationship of self-care and a relationship of ensuring that we are giving ourselves what we need to maintain our energy so that we can live a deeply purposeful life. So I'm curious to understand what actual tools do you use and put in place to do these things and to maintain this balance that you've just referred to? Because I think it is so important.
And it is such a big and important question. And I think, and first of all, I will completely agree with you that the responsibility that is parenthood can be quite heavy, even paralyzing to your point at times. But I hope that I can give you some encouragement in saying that I have seen now, you know, as a couple of my children are now 18 and 20, that everything that, you know, we try to instill in them and the lessons that we try to help teach them, it's all coming back around. And it is a beautiful thing, Rebecca. So keep going with that 5-year-old.
Thank you. I did selfishly ask you that question. I'm like, help me out.
Yes, it happens.
Yeah.
So as far as tools, I mean, these may sound very simple, but you know, one of the things that I do, and I do this on Sunday nights, basically because that is a time when I feel I am best equipped to kind of prepare myself for the week. I literally will go through my calendar during my week, and I will block out the times when I know I want to be, you know, making lunch, when I know that I want to be taking my walks, when I know that there may be, you know, some activities that I would like to attend with my kids, and blocking those off on my calendar as if they were anything else, right? Like, this is sacred time for me. And no, I will not be attending meetings, you know, during these times, because I am caring for myself, or, you know, attending to my children's needs or whatever that might be. That is absolutely a practice that I have, man, that's been part of my life for years and years. And I, like I said, I'm very, very protective of that time. And so I will decline meetings. I will propose new times. I won't give that time up. And I think that's something that I find myself talking with people about quite a bit, because I hear often, you know, other people saying, well, gosh, I really was hoping to XYZ, you know, during this time, but now I have this thing that's, you know, come into my path. And that's, I always kind of respond by saying, you know, negotiate a new time. There's nothing stopping us from doing that. And to your point earlier, this is all about energy management and knowing when you have the energy to do certain things. And so another practice, I guess, that I've put into place for myself is knowing that mornings are not my time. And I, you know, spend my mornings more, you know, kind of catching up on the latest news, you know, eating a nice breakfast, you know, versus making sure that I'm, you know, scheduling meetings for 7 a.m. Or, you know, trying to do something that's too thought intensive. That's just, it feels forced for me. And I know people won't get the best of me if I try to do those types of things during those times. So I know for myself that I need to do those more thought intensive things more toward mid-afternoon, you know, after my younger kids are in bed. Sometimes, you know, if I'm feeling creative, I often get my creative juices later at night. That's just me.
You know your flow.
Exactly. And we all have those flows. And I think kind of taking charge of those is something that we all need to do, and not force ourselves to do things at times when we know people won't get the best of us.
So you referenced that your kids are now kind of in that 18, 20 age mark. And so what I'd love to ask you is, in listening to your story, I found it quite interesting that where you started in studying psychology and criminal justice and actually working in criminal justice was so far away from where your purpose really built momentum. And so it made me wonder if you were able to give advice to your younger self, or maybe even to your kids entering the workplace, what advice would you give them in relation to finding their one true purpose?
Oh, goodness. And you, You know that, yes, I have been having these conversations with my children. Somehow you've seen into our home life here. because the conversations that I have been having with them, which are along these lines, is to stay open. And by that, I mean, life is full of twists and turns. And actually, there's a book that I read as well, The Year of Yes by Shonda Rhimes. It was given to me by a previous boss. And The Year of Yes is kind of also along these same lines, which is, as you are open to new opportunities and new doors that might open, saying yes allows you to experiment. And experimentation, I think, has been a kind of a hallmark of my own life. I didn't necessarily call things experimentation as I was going through them. But when I look back, that's what I was doing. I was kind of testing myself. I was testing whether I would like something, whether I could do something, you know, whether something would excite me enough to want to continue. And some things did, some things didn't, but I never would have known unless I had said yes to walking through the doors. And so my 18-year-old, actually, who was in his freshman year at college, texted me the other day and he said, Mom, I don't know where I'm going to be in 5 years. I mean, this was his text. And he's always been a kind of a kid that's wanted to be organized and kind of know what the future holds. And I said,
have certainty about it all. Yeah.
Yeah. That's okay. And that's normal. And to be able to, and I'm going to use your phrase, Rebecca, that you used at the beginning of this podcast, to be able to hold space for what may come next is where you need to be right now. And so even though you may be doing something now that you may not be doing in 5 years, you may be studying something now to my son that you may not be doing anything in the realm of in 5 years, that is completely okay. Life is about trying and failing, trying and succeeding. And that's the thrill. That's the excitement. That's, you know, the fun of it all. So I don't even know if I answered your question, Rebecca. Look,
I absolutely love your answer. And this might feel like I'm jumping around a little bit, and I am about to dive right into the nuts and bolts of your body of work. However, I know in looking at your background, there were other points where you've had quite significant career transition. So in 2016, moving away from the consultancy into your work with Accenture is one example of that. And I'm right in one of those transitions at the moment where I've been in the professional speaking industry and the world of influence for the last 15 years, and literally this year put myself into the wilderness. And I've enjoyed the freedom, but I have to say there have been times where I've really had to shed my old identity and, you know, sit in this really uncomfortable place of not actually knowing. And so I loved that you spoke about this idea of holding space for the unknown and what that tension looks like, because that's not just about what happens in our 20s when we're working out our career path. That's actually what happens in every moment that we choose to lean into something new and step into that personal transformation. And again, to put that into the context of today's world, a world of relentless change, where we're all needing to adapt, where there's AI, automation, all of these things coming at us all of the time, this ability to hold space for the unknown is like such an imperative. So I absolutely loved what you shared.
Well, I think it's something that sounds so simple, really, when you think about it. And there's many sayings that kind of allude to the same nature of that phrase of, you know, holding space for the unknown. And until you do it, I don't think you truly understand the transformative nature of it. And so for you, and you've probably seen me jotting some notes here. I love the phrases you're using about now being kind of, going into the wilderness, right? And literally, you know, kind of needing to survive and needing to find new ways to survive and function and operate. And that can come with a whole host of its own emotions. And so it's finding comfort also in that space of the unknown. And that comfort can take time, I think, to grow within ourselves. And to your point, it's, you know, something that continues to grow, I think, throughout adulthood, because throughout our different seasons of life, we are always finding ourselves, I think, in places where things can be unknown and we need to walk through them.
Yeah, it reminds me. I was reading about the root, like, of the word confidence, and I didn't actually know this at the time. I came across, I think, on social media, this phrase, but that confidence actually translates back to trust yourself, to trust yourself. And it resonated with me so much because it's so easy to think that confidence is something that we achieve with repetition, like we build up those muscles and then we are confident, which in many aspects is true. But if you actually go back to the root core, like the root of that word, the root meaning, it is to trust oneself.
That is definitely something to think about, because to your point, it is kind of chicken or egg. It's, you know, do I do things that help me become confident, or am I in this state of trusting myself, which is the root of the word, and is the state of trusting myself helping me to be able to do these things?
Yes.
I mean, we could talk about that one for the next hour.
I have already gone down so many rabbit holes in the first half an hour of this podcast. So I'm going to come back to your story, but loving this conversation. Let's go back in time again so that we can get a foundation down for your professional journey and talk about the world of Best Buy. Now, I know that you landed your job at Best Buy when you happened to come across a role for an HR assistant, but it wasn't too long before you were, you know, moving into our other areas of the business and found yourself in a little bit of a paper heavy admin role when you approached one of your leaders and said, "Hey, look, I want to spice things up a little bit here." That leader happened to believe in you. And essentially, this was the beginning of a model, a way of working that really focused on a results-only work environment. So I'm really curious to know and would love to hear about how the story of your approach to work and your body of work was seeded at Best Buy, what it was all about and how it evolved.
Yes, and that is true, that it was my very first job right out of college. And essentially, I was feeling stifled by the way things were operating. And I very much felt that there was a disconnect between what the company and leadership were saying that they wanted to foster in the culture and what was actually happening. And at that time that you're speaking of, which was the early 2000s, there was a big problem with employee turnover. Lots of people were leaving, and Best Buy was trying to find out why, right? Why are people leaving? And so in what I was starting to kind of research and figure out, it's that people weren't feeling trusted. They weren't feeling trusted to live their lives and do their work in a way that they felt was most effective and most productive. And so it goes back kind of to what we talked about at the beginning, those fundamental human needs and that agency over how, when, and where I work wasn't there. It wasn't being met. Mm-hmm. And so people were voting with their feet and they were leaving. And so I ended up piloting with a group of about 300-ish people in one department at Best Buy, a new way of thinking, a new way of working that didn't focus on time or physical presence. It just focused on the results that people needed to deliver. What is it that you need to do? By when? How are we measuring it? And who is it that is your customer that we're trying to, you know, please in this situation? And once people were aligned with that and on the same page, there was a freedom that was felt kind of across the board, whether I was a leader, whether I was an individual contributor. When we were all together on what needed to be achieved, it didn't matter anymore if I was seen physically at 8 a.m. or if I was seen physically at 2 p.m. or if I wasn't seen physically at all, you know, during the day. There was an accountability that came with that autonomy. And so ultimately what ended up happening is that group was successful and it became pretty viral, Rebecca, in the sense that people who now were experiencing this new mindset and this new way of living and working started talking about it. And they started telling their friends and, you know, other departments, you know, this is the way that I'm, you know, working now. And it's amazing. And my life is, you know, changing. And so other people started, you know, asking for also this, why can't we work in this way? Mm. And it spread. And ultimately, that is what led to my next chapter, which was kind of being birthed out of Best Buy and into a boutique consulting career that lasted about 10 years before Accenture.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, as I was doing my research, I came across a little affirmation card that I've got at home, which simply states, life is a journey filled with unexpected miracles. And when I was listening to how your career unfolded at this particular point in time, it aligned completely with this affirmation card. To give that context, in 2004, Best Buy initiated what was called innovation incubators and essentially offered you the chance to head up a startup funded by Best Buy focused on cultural transformation, your sweet spot, and which also reflected the work that you'd been doing at Best Buy. You were in your mid to late 20s, and this led you to land on the cover of Business Week magazine. From there, the idea was planted to write a book, and this led you to have 13 meetings with book publishers, and 12 of those publishers wanted the rights to the book, which was called Why Work Sucks and How to Fix It. I mean, what a wild ride at that particular point in time.
It was. And I think back on that, and that was, like you said earlier, my life has been a wild ride full of many kind of mini adventures. And yeah. One of those mini adventures was writing that first book, something that I never thought I would do, right? I didn't grow up thinking I would love to write a book. And so when this opportunity came my way, it was a door, right? It was one of those say yes opportunities, even though you haven't ever thought of it or haven't ever wanted that, say yes. And in saying yes, exactly what you said happened. And that first book, you know, kind of came out to the world as the manifesto of what a results-only work environment is, how it operates, gave people and organizations some, you know, tips and tricks for how they might start planting some seeds in their own organizations. And then a few years later, wrote another book that I said yes to as well. So that chapter, I would say, in my life, was one that was, it was full of, you know, the books, it was full of speaking engagements, it was full of consulting opportunities. All that, I would say, kind of culminated in this moment in about 2015, 2016, where I realized that a movement had been catalyzed. And I acknowledged and I recognized in myself that that's what I'd always wanted. Yes, there was this innovation incubator at Best Buy that spun off this, you know, business that I was able to and fortunate enough to lead. But at the end of the day, I wanted to spark a movement. And that's what I realized happened, which was an amazing feeling.
So for the purpose-driven leaders out there, the change makers who have these kind of wild revolutionary ideas, and you know, it can be so easy to go like, oh, this idea doesn't matter. This won't change any paradigms. I'm just going to give up. In your view, if you were to break down the mechanisms of the movement, what did you do?
I would say the most, going on a limb here, I would say the most important thing was focusing on the people who were coming along. And by that, I mean, I think it can be easy for movement, people who want to create and sustain movements, to focus on the people that you want to convince, right? Because you don't want people to not see what you see. And so, for example, you know, if I was talking with a group of 100 people and, you know, 90 of them were nodding their heads and were seemingly excited about where things were going, but there were 10 that I could see were kind of, you know, the curmudgeons and kind of, you know,
on the back
thinking
foot.
This is never going to work. Yeah, this isn't for me. You know, she's crazy. Those were the people at the very beginning that I zoned in on. And I tried and tried to convince and convince until I realized it's not worth the energy. The energy in a movement is best spent on those 90 people who are ready. They are inspired, they want to come along, and they will help the movement. They will help be the magnet that pulls others forward. So I would say first and foremost, it's making sure that energy is being spent on the right people. And then I would say that kind of another piece of the making of a movement is helping the people that are in that movement feel special. So that, because at the end of the day, you need to grow and grow and grow the amount of people in the movement who will become, again, the magnet. And so you need to keep fostering them. You need to keep nurturing them so that they, you know, continue to evangelize, continue to spread the message, continue to do whatever it is that will help the movement. And I think that the other piece is to kind of feel comfort in the fact that the movement might not always twist and turn in the way that you thought it would. Again, it kind of all goes back to let life unfold. And so when you put a movement in the hands of people, those people are going to make it their own. And that's exactly what needs to happen for it to build and spread. So chances are that whatever it is that you might be dreaming of as that end state, it might not look exactly like that, you know, as things unfold. But that only means that the people have taken hold and, you know, they're making it what it needs to be for humanity to be able to continue to take it forward.
Yeah, I love that. They've found their own narrative in it, and then it's become this beautiful, beautifully evolving shared narrative, and it has a life unto itself. So in that sense, you're the mother. The child is free.
Right. I don't just have four children. I have, you know, thousands of children.
A whole movement there. Exactly. It reminds me very much of the Steve Jobs quote that you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards.
Yes. Very good. Very good quote. Love that.
What I find super interesting just in the context of the world of work today is that if we were talking today about results-only work and the mechanisms to measure performance through that lens, it makes a lot of sense because in today's context, we have the technology to support that. We have, you know, flexible working and hybrid working models emerging and all of these things. But what's quite incredible about the journey you have gone on is you were doing this work all the way back in the early 2000s where it didn't seem to have the relevance that it has in 2023.
That is very true. And I've had that, you know, kind of said to me many times that, you know, what you were doing was well before its time. And I do agree with that. And I think that the anchor of a results-only work environment, which is the results, which is the outcomes that we need to achieve and being on the same page with that. And I mean, that is kind of an evergreen idea, right? Mm. That we need to be aligned with what it is we need to achieve. And it would seem that if we're aligned, that, like I said before, and what happened at Best Buy, that there would be, you know, this kind of understanding that we're on the same page, and therefore, Rebecca, you know, you have agency over how, where, and when you do your work, because I trust that you will be accountable to what we've agreed to. Mm. However, I think that what we're seeing right now in the landscape is more of just a fundamental need for control. So, in other words, I think that, you know, in some organizations, there can be alignment around, you know, results and what needs to be achieved and all is well, and people do have agency. However, I do believe that there are people in leadership positions today that truly just have a deep-seated desire for control. And that's really what it comes down to. And
why do they? Let's lean into that because I really want to get inside the mindset of the 2023 leader and the paradigm shift that needs to happen here.
Yeah. I think that at the end of the day, it comes down to a little bit of insecurity of leaders in their own kind of ability to take that approach that we talked about earlier in terms of, you know, what is that modern leader? That modern leader is someone who sheds, you know, most or all of their ego to be able to show up consistently, authentically, you know, with that very high level of emotional intelligence and inclusivity and trust. And that takes a great amount, in my opinion, of security in who you are, right? And what you can bring to the table. If I am going to be a leader who openly admits, you know, in a town hall setting, for example, that, you know, I don't have all the answers, right? Obviously, I'm providing enough guidance for, you know, greater strategy and those kinds of things. But if I'm willing to say, I don't have all the answers, and I am excited to be working with people like you who have amazing ideas and thoughts and, you know, next steps and things that you have to share. I want to hear those because I think that those will help me and help our company. Just those statements in and of themselves are statements that I don't think you'd hear every leader today make. And I think that when, and I heard, I'm going to go back to Tennille again, because in the conversation you had with her, she mentioned, and I wholeheartedly agree, that it often takes some kind of, you know, unfortunately, event in someone's life, whether it's a very, you know, unfortunate professional or personal mm-hmm. event, to help people kind of wake up.
Absolutely. I've seen that pattern in the discovery of purpose time and time again. Yes. And I'm not sure if it's the crisis that does it or the chasm of vulnerability that asks someone to lean into courage. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think it's the latter, that it is a choice. However, that is often catalyzed by some extreme event that throws someone into the depth of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Which right or wrong, I mean, that is what you've seen, it's what I've seen. Mm. And so I think, you know, the more people can share when they are kind of thrown into that position and when they kind of make that transformation within themselves, and the more they can share the goodness of that and, you know, what came out of it that has actually helped them personally, has helped their organizations, is something that even if it, you know, impacts a handful of people, to kind of sit back and question their own practices and their own mindsets, I think that's the way it's going to happen. It's going to happen, you know, a handful of people at a time. And, you know, I used to work myself up over the fact that, you know, there are some leaders who are very command and control, who just are not operating in that modern leadership way. But I have kind of come to terms with that as well. I have faith in the human species. Mm. I believe that people will continue to vote with their feet. And I'm confident then that the tide will turn. As a matter of fact, I was just interviewed for a book that's coming out early next year called Unleadership by Allison and Scott Stratton. And in that book, it's basically a compilation of narratives around, you know, what a modern leader looks like. And I think that, you know, first of all, Scott and Allison, if your listeners don't know who they are some serious straight shooters. And
sounds like we might need to have them on the podcast.
I'm happy to make that intro.
Bookmark.
They've done the work for us kind of pinpointing who are those people that we need to listen to who can help guide and navigate us in this world of, you know, the new kind of leadership. Mm. Because we kind of need all the guides we can get.
Yeah, the blueprint.
Exactly.
So, Kelly, I just want to underscore your current experience because, you know, in our journey today, we kind of stopped at 2016 and spoke about the career transition. However, that transition was that you ended up taking a role with Accenture. Now, I believe you might have had another transition earlier this year from listening to a previous episode, but correct me if I'm wrong. However, what I do know is that you have worked as the head of global employee experience at Accenture. So you were dealing with these leadership issues firsthand. You know, you've had the highest level of experience to be making the comments and sharing the insights in relation to leadership that you have just shared with us.
Yes, and that's right. I just earlier this year have moved into this role in employee experience. Previous to that, I was heading up what we call performance achievement for North America at Accenture. And so in this role now with employee experience, it is kind of the role of a lifetime, I will say, because I am fortunate enough to, you know, be able to be working with the world's biggest brands, who are asking the questions that we've been talking about here today, and that really do want to make sure that they are meeting those fundamental human needs that people have, and understanding that it does take energy, and it takes time, and it takes dedication and commitment to putting people at the center of everything we do. Because, you know, as trite as it is, you know, people are our greatest asset.
Mm.
They are. And unless we treat them that way and care for them, we're going to, you know, reap negative consequences, especially in this day and age where, you know, we have AI and Gen AI that are coming into the fold, when those really are paving the way for humans to uncover, I believe, their greatest purpose, right? Like, we're at this moment where humans are now able to say, okay, we need to dig down into what makes us uniquely human and bring that to the forefront in a really, really big and impactful way. But to do that as organizations, that's where it comes full circle. We need to be meeting those fundamental needs in order for people to be able to feel like they can kind of step into the spotlight in the way that is needed today. Mm.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And when you were sharing your answer in relation to how potentially some leaders need to evolve, I was thinking about the simple fact that, well, human beings are actually built to evolve. It's just that often we need that external stimulus to step us into that next level. And I think actually AI and automation and some of these trends, whilst they are incredibly uncomfortable, and whilst the technology is amazing, counterintuitively, this is actually placing the focus back on not only what it means to be human through the lens of what we already know, it's placing the focus on what it means to be human through the lens of what we don't know, what we're yet to know about ourselves and our potential and who we can be in the world.
Oh my goodness. I couldn't agree more. Mm. I couldn't agree more. And I mean, what an exciting time to be alive.
I know, right? I mean,
what an exciting time to have all of this, you know, kind of happening and unfolding right before our eyes. Mm. I agree. It's where does the bar, how high is high, I guess, when it comes to human impact?
Absolutely.
That's kind of the question that's out there right now. We don't know.
Yeah.
We literally don't know right now. And that, I mean, it's pretty amazing to think that we can just kind of keep going and going. It's kind of like my kids used to say when they were little and they would ask about infinity, you know, so what is infinity again? You know, or what, how far does the universe go? It's like, there is no answer. It just keeps going and going. And that's human impact.
Mm.
Keeps going and going and going.
Mm. And I think it's fair to say that never before has there been a more significant time for us to lean into this evolution in relation to issues pertaining to sustainability and also issues relating to human progress, like diversity and inclusion and gender equality. I'm really curious to get inside your mind with regards to how you feel that corporate organizations should begin to be part of the change that we seek. Now, I think traditionally we've often seen targets attached to things like, you know, environmental and social goals, for example, or diversity, inclusion, whatever it is, that it's kind of, there are targets. This is a separate silo over here. We do the work here and we try to reach these targets. Where I've often felt that this kind of systemic change is actually about cultural transformation, that we really need to embed these changes within the very fabric of how we live, work and play. Like there needs to be a fundamental shift. So I just wanted to invite you to riff on that subject with me a little bit to get inside what you think about these shifts.
Goodness. Yes. I mean, they are organizational and cultural foundations that absolutely need to, I think, be the breath and the air around us, you know, as we think about topics like inclusion and diversity and sustainability, because at the end of the day, I believe it all comes back to our belief systems, right? It comes back to how our brains are wired. And that wiring, again, it goes back to what, you know, you asked me about my own childhood, and, you know, how my brain was wired, how all of our brains begin to be wired at a very young age. And then every experience that we have, you know, does something to that wiring. So now we're all in the workplace together and we all have different wiring and we're all supposed to come together and, you know, collaborate against various, you know, missions and visions. But to be able to sustain long-term change, we have to rewire. Mm. And the rewiring is something that I've seen happen in kind of in what we call an adaptive change process that does seek to literally, you know, help unearth, you know, the orthodoxies and beliefs that we all have and change them. And that's what I believe at the end of the day is required for these kind of really, really big, very societally important topics that you're talking about. It's not going to be something that shifts or changes because we offer trainings and, you know, different, you know, year-long programs for people to go through. I think those are nice. Those provide awareness, but they don't create the long-lasting, systemic, sustainable change that we need within organizations.
Mm. Yeah, it really speaks to the idea that the most powerful story we can ever tell is the story we tell to ourselves about ourselves.
That's right. That's right. I love that.
Yeah. Well,
it's very powerful. It's very powerful. And until we change those narratives, and then in turn can help share those new narratives with others and have impact and influence on them, and help to kind of, you know, work with their wiring. You're right. It all comes back to what we tell ourselves. You're absolutely right.
So Kelly, it is clear to me that you have had an incredible journey. What's next in the story of Kelly Ressler?
Oh, goodness. What is next? You know, I have been toying with writing another book. It's funny because I take these daily walks that I mentioned earlier, and it's often on those walks when I get these kinds of sparks of energy around a book or a podcast or, you know, how I think for me, it's this next chapter of getting a voice out into the world around the kinds of things we've been talking about, Rebecca, about staying open, saying yes. I am also, you know, a very big proponent, and we touched on this around, you know, mental wellness. And I think that for me is another part of my next chapter. Simply because I only became very open about talking about that about 3 years ago now. And ever since then, I have just felt this lightness, and I would love for other people to have that feeling as well. And so I don't have the, you know, details around what this next chapter is, but I do know that it's going to be a more personal one, and kind of sharing and bringing others into hopefully a place for themselves where they can learn to hold that space
absolutely
for the unknown and for themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's so often that when we have the courage to speak our truth, that in that moment we have the power to heal the world, because other people can find their truth in the resonance of your voice. And, you know, I think it's amazing to see that particularly young people talking so much more openly about mental health challenges. And like you, I've been on my own journey. However, it's not so often that maybe you hear people in our generation talking about it openly. And I think that conversation is as equally as important as it is for young people, because, you know, if we're able to create, you know, a shared narrative around those experiences, we can more readily support each other to unite and evolve as a species.
That's right. I completely agree. Yes. And we are, each one of us is the example for others. Each voice helps others, as you're saying, you know, think about things for themselves and hopefully, you know, start using their own voice for others too. It's a ripple effect.
So Kelly, I've come to my last question for today. What I'm curious to know is, if you had access to the biggest billboard in the world where you could write a single word or phrase that encapsulates your most profound realization or contribution to the world, what would you say and why?
Goodness, Rebecca.
We end with a bang or a billboard.
Oh,
anyway.
My. I think it would be trust yourself.
Love it.
And yeah, I mean, I think it kind of encapsulates what we've been talking about here, right?
Yeah.
I imagine myself driving down the freeway, seeing a billboard that says trust yourself, and kind of reflecting, right? Like, what does that mean? And in the end, that's, I think, as we go through life, what we always need to fall back on and lean into all at the same time. What we have in ourselves, what we know about ourselves, what we feel inside, what we know in our heads, in our hearts, in our souls, it's enough. It's enough.
Kelly, I know there will be so many listeners out there who will want to follow along with your work, buy that next book, buy your previous books. I'm definitely the first on the list for that next book. So where can we find you?
You can find me on LinkedIn. I am at LinkedIn / CALIRESSLER. And I would love to connect with anyone who's listening. Absolutely.
Amazing. Kelly, it has been an absolute joy to have you on the podcast today. I've just so enjoyed this conversation. My heart is full. Thank you so much for coming on the DNA of Purpose podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel the same way. You're starting your day, I'm ending my day, and both of us have full hearts. So that's the way to go. I like it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining me on the DNA of Purpose, Kelly Ressler. Thank you, as always, for dedicating your time to the DNA of Purpose podcast. As we conclude today's episode, I invite you to extend the conversation online. Feel free to reach out via LinkedIn or follow along at Rebecca Maklad, that is MAKLAD, on Instagram, where we're crafting a tapestry of stories, reflections, tools, and insights to empower your purpose-driven leadership strategy. I love feedback, and we always welcome guest suggestions. Should today's episode ignite a spark within you, reviews really do help us to continue to attract
the world's most prominent purpose-driven leaders as our guests. And if you know somebody who would benefit from one of our episodes, then share that story with abundance. A big thanks to Supernova Tribe, who produce this podcast with style, and Guide Your Light, a network for podcasts with purpose.